You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. In the wars raging around the world, medical workers find themselves in the crosshairs as hospitals become part of the battlefield. The creators of the documentary The New Barbarianism join FSI faculty to talk about how to keep humanitarian workers and civilians safe. This episode comes to you courtesy of the Stanford Center for Innovation in Global Health.
Welcome. My name is Michelle Berry, and I'm the Dean of Global Health at Stanford. And it gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce the screening of The New Barbarianism and a panel discussion. Just as an introduction to this film, medical and humanitarian workers are increasingly in the crosshairs as hospitals and aid centers have become part of the battlefield in today's wars. So far, there has been little to stop the profound surge of violence seen across many open-ended conflicts, which have claimed thousands of lives, many of my coworkers, destroyed health systems, triggered mass displacement and state collapse, and really exposed the crisis facing the norms of international humanitarian law contained in the Geneva Conventions. The New Barbarianism is a CSIS Global Health Policy Center original feature documentary that examines the crisis, its causes, the limited international response, and possible ways forward through the dozens of interviews and original footage obtained from inside Syria, Yemen, and Afghanistan. It builds on several years of the center's prior work on the introduction of health and security, the role of militaries, and the human tragedies seen in Syria and Yemen. The film recently won two awards of excellence in the 2018 Impact Docs Awards and is CSIS's most ambitious video project to date. The film was directed by Steve Morrison, who we are very pleased to have here. He's the Senior Vice President and the Director of CSIS Global Health Policy. And Emmy and Peabody winning journalist Justin Kenny, both of whom you will have the pleasure not only of hearing from this evening, but hopefully having a back and forth dialogue in our panel event to follow. I want to thank Steve and Justin for being here with us tonight, as well as our fabulous panelists, Ambassador Erthrin Cousin and Professor Paul Wise, who will be joining me on stage after the film. I also want to thank Steve Stedman and the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law for co-hosting this event with us, as well as the Stanford Refugee Research Project. Stay tuned for that, for how you can get involved. And the Honda Center for Human Rights and International Justice for their sponsorship of this evening. This is an especially timely and important documentary as we are witness to the catastrophic situation that is happening right now as we show this film in Syria's East Ghouta, which has included a series of attacks on humanitarian sites and health facilities, leaving over 700 civilians and many health workers dead. Today, actually just today, the Syrian government permitted aid trucks to enter the besieged area of Eastern Ghouta, the first time humanitarian aid has been able to enter the area since really it's been like many weeks. Despite an agreement that the aid would be delivered in safety, the government, while these convoys were coming in, pressed on with more air and ground attacks. The WHO reported Syrian officials stripped 70% of the needed medical supplies from this convoy today, including surgical supplies and trauma kits. I hope we get to discuss this event after this movie. I'm going to start this conversation off by asking Steve and Justin, what motivated you to actually make this documentary?
Thank you so much. First of all, Michelle and Steve Stedman, thanks so much for co-organizing this and getting the word out, and a very special thanks to Rachel Leslie for all her help in putting this together on a fairly short schedule. We're delighted to be here, and thanks to everyone in the audience for joining us here. There were a couple of reasons that motivated us to do this. I think the single most important reason was the recognition that the world had changed and that this form of violence, targeted and deliberate violence against the health sector and humanitarians, had become very commonplace across multiple open-ended wars. This was a phenomenon that was new and different in my estimation, and it was one that was not fully understood. And so that big idea was one that animated this movie, was trying to bring that across, explain it, dissect it, talk about what the implications were, and talk about what strategies of action were being undertaken to mitigate it. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that we could do it. We knew that we had the capacity to do this. We had learned from a previous film a number of things about putting these films together. We had much more internal capacity at CSIS in recent years in order to carry this forward. And most importantly, the many people that you saw in this film and another 10 or 12 who didn't make it into the film were willing to trust us. They had the confidence in us early on, months before they would ever see any final product, to come on camera and speak their minds honestly and candidly to us, so that we had a prodigious amount of very, very powerful material in order to do this. And the last reason we did this was because we found Justin. And and he was able to work magic in many, many ways, which stepped up our game significantly. So those are the main reasons. Over to you, Justin.
Yep, Justin, what is it like to go into those areas? And
well, one of the things that we tried I'm just going to take a step back, is Steve had a very good idea about all the individuals we needed to talk to, and he made the right decisions on that. One of the things that I've tried to do as a journalist is to sort of, throughout my career, is to try to give voice and show people the suffering that's going around in different conflict zones. Because I think it's very different to read a headline, and even, unfortunately, the limitations of a nightly newscast, you just really don't see these people as individuals. You see them as people in crisis that are flashing by the screen. And for me, it was really important to connect viewers with their experiences. And unfortunately, in places like Syria and Yemen, we are up against the same odds that a lot of humanitarians are, where it's virtually impossible to move around. So one of the things that I got really good at PBS was being lean and mean and strategic with no money. And that really helped out. And with a little bit of patience, we were able to sort of navigate that. In Syria, we worked with the Aleppo Media Group. And some of you may have heard the name Kareem Abid. And Kareem just was allowed to come in to the Oscars for the film that he worked on. He's a producer, Last Men in Aleppo. Unfortunately, it didn't win last night. But Kareem was a partner to me, and I talked about the type of film that we're doing, and we worked with his folks, and they're the ones who gave us that dramatic drone footage, and they got some really compelling visuals from inside Syria's hospitals, which we would not have been able to do without them. With Yemen, to say that Yemen is a forgotten war is a massive understatement today. There are very few journalists going in, and even if you can get in, it's virtually impossible to get out. So there's a very vacuum of global awareness. So what we did was we just kind of thought strategically. We ended up working with some underemployed filmmakers in Sana'a, and we worked very closely with the IMC. And for 6 weeks, we carefully negotiated. We actually had to have the IMC go and negotiate with different parties within the city to negotiate just shooting across the city. And patients, it won the day. And we're proud to say that we're one of the few, documentaries in the past year to have gotten inside of Yemen to show it closely. And that's how we did it.
And that cholera epidemic is still going on, yeah. Unfortunately.
Just to that point, we taped Steve about a week and a half before we had our premiere in September to get the latest cholera numbers. And 500,000 at that time was mind-blowing. And we've just had to update the film, of course, in the last few weeks, because in December we went over 1 million, and it's unbelievable.
Earthman, can I? You were the executive director for the World Food Program. You had to send your people into insecure settings like this. Can you share a little bit about how you did that, what went through your head, how you convinced people to go?
The humanitarians at work in responses like Syria and Aleppo and Somalia and South Sudan, Northeast Nigeria, you don't have to convince those people to go. This is what they do. They are committed to doing it. But what I would often say was they are not military. They have committed their lives to serving affected populations in need, not to fighting conflicts, and definitely not to becoming victims of the conflict. And unfortunately, when you see indiscriminate bombings of UN convoys or hospitals, then we are seeing an increased number of humanitarians affected by the conflict and in their determination to continue to serve. I was looking at the footage of the bombing of Aleppo, and I recall very clearly the UN Security Council conversations and the commitments by the parties, particularly the Assad regime, to allowing a convoy into Aleppo before the bombing campaign would begin. Or then after the bombing campaign began, much like we're seeing in Eastern Ghouta now, where they committed to ceasefires and allowing a convoy in. And I remember clearly hiring drivers, paying them exorbitant amounts of money to go in to Eastern Aleppo when a opening came through. And we were paying them every single day to sit because the opening never came through. And it's just like today when we saw the Eastern Ghouta, and you get a convoy on the road and it is moving and the bombings begin. And the convoy has two choices. You go forward into the bombing or you turn around and people are starved. They don't receive the assistance. And I should just add, on these convoys, WFP was responsible, of course, for bringing in food assistance, but as the primary logisticians for the humanitarian community, we also carried the medical equipment many times. But just as you saw 70% of the medical assistance materials removed from the convoy for Eastern Ghouta, that was regular. It was chronic in convoys where once approval was given for a convoy to go, when the convoys were inspected, that particularly surgical sutures and other medical appliances were removed from convoys. And so the things that are documented in this film are simply, and it's a horrible thing to think about, but I was able to, as I was sitting there watching this again, it reminded me that this has become, in humanitarian response, in these what are now becoming protracted conflicts, have become a not just a challenge, but almost a chronic lack of access to parties in need is becoming part of how the conflict is waged. And this is exactly what the Geneva Conventions and customary international humanitarian law is supposed to preclude. But it's changing. And we are witnessing the change without the appropriate outcry from the international community.
Well, I was struck by David Miliband's statement that we're fighting war without laws now. So I want to push it back to Steve for a second, but I'm going to get to you, Paul. Should we reopen the Geneva Conventions? Where should we go?
This is a really difficult question. The world has, as we indicate in the movie, the nature of warfare, the technology, the nature of warfare has changed profoundly. And there are all sorts of very highly ambiguous situations involving armed, violent, non-state groups. There is the age of counterterror, but there is no stomach, there's no will at the present moment to reopen the Geneva Conventions. And by that I mean there's no coalition of the most powerful states coming forward and saying this is a step that has to be taken now. And one of the big reasons for that is, of course, that the world is so fractured. You would not get major powers like Russia or China agreeing to do that. And moreover, be careful what you wish for, because we're in an age of counterterror doctrine and law. And if you reopen, and it's in direct tension with international humanitarian law. So if you reopen the entire operation, you put yourself at high risk. And so the custodians of international humanitarian law, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Swiss government, many of the other staunchest supporters are adamantly opposed to that. So it leads us then to how do you begin to improve international humanitarian law by other methods? And I think there are steps that can be taken, one of which is simply to revitalize the popular appreciation of what the Geneva Conventions mean and begin speaking in that terminology, because we've lost, certainly in the American public, we've lost that appreciation. The other thing is to change our own national law, because each country has on its books laws that are drawn from the Geneva Conventions, which translate into operational practice how we conduct war. And those can be updated, and that is not going to be easy, but that's something that can and should be done by us as well as other major power militaries.
Can I just interject here? May I?
I'm going to open it up to Q&A also, yeah. So don't worry. I'm getting to you too.
As I listen to Steve, violently agree with your statements regarding now is not the time to reopen the Geneva mm-hmm. Convention. We were able to agree to the Geneva Convention because we were coming out of World War II, and you had a basic consensus around the world of never again would we have
a dominant winner.
And a dominant winner, yes. The national laws, changing national law here in the United States on international humanitarian law will run directly into conflict with our terrorism, our anti-terrorism laws. And the challenge is that between the American public today, between a commitment to humanitarian principles versus fighting terrorism, we'll see fighting terrorism has the higher priority. And I think those of us who are committed to the Geneva Convention and international humanitarian law have a responsibility before going to policy, attempting policy change, to build a coalition here in the United States in support of IHL as opposed to anti-terrorism laws.
Paul, you're the doctor on the panel. And I know you've been recently to Iraq. There's been a statement that if you kill one doctor, you really kill 20 or 40 people, because you're taking the ability of that person to cure. Can you make some comments on what you saw in Iraq and how the WHO is reacting to treating civilians?
Yeah, I was part of a small group to evaluate the health response to the fighting in Mosul. It was a terrible urban battle that looked very much like the pictures we just saw from Aleppo and from Yemen. But before I comment, I just need to publicly state what a remarkable achievement Steve and Justin, the film, is. And I mentioned to Steve that I've been in a lot of complex places, but I still found it moving and inspiring. And I really am very glad to know that it's going to be broadcast and other ways to enhance its impact in the real world. So we were there to assess the fighting, the health response in Mosul. And what happened in Mosul is a kind of illustration of the complexity of the modern battlefield and its implications for a humanitarian response. There were far more civilian casualties than expected. ISIS had 2 years to develop a defense, and Iraqi security forces with US and coalition support moved in. There was basically no capability to take care of the civilians injured during the battle. And the United States went to the World Health Organization to quickly set up a trauma system for civilians. And WHO said, fine, went to Doctors Without Borders, the ICRC, help us do this. They said, great, but the standard of medical care has changed. And you need to move forward. You need to stabilize patients as close to where the injury occurs as possible. People think of it as a kind of golden hour. And we know that that will save lives. And MSF and the ICRC said that you can't go to the front lines. We'll do our usual, we'll be back and take referrals. And WHO said, well, we're going to find docs who will go to the front line. And the Iraqi security forces will protect you. MSF, ICR said that's a gross violation of humanitarian principles of neutrality and independence. WHO said the technical imperative is real. We need to move forward. And they found a medical group, some medical groups, and functionally embedded them with Iraqi special forces at the front line. And so MSF and ICRC saw this as a flagrant violation and contaminated the whole humanitarian space around Mosul. At the same time, WHO was saying we're saving lives. And our job was to come in to assess and make sense of this. And what we found was that indeed they saved lives by moving forward. It wasn't 20,000 like some people suggested, but it was substantial. But it was also a fundamental violation of humanitarian principles. And we had to come up with some options that would create a renewed consensus among the humanitarian groups that would protect the humanitarians from being viewed as a combatant force, but at the same time, responding and respecting the technical imperative to move forward. What is important to understand is that surgery in these areas, that stabilization and medical care in areas of conflict are far more effective now than they were even 30 years ago. And that the compelling nature of moving forward to provide care in these conflict areas has never been greater, at the same time where the risks have also never been greater. Well, we basically tried to recognize and reiterate is that international humanitarian law is an attempt to place humanity in war. And to do that requires the exercise of power. And then for many years, the global relationships, power relationships, functionally supported humanitarian law and the protection of humanitarian health workers. And that has largely evaporated. And our attempt will need to be to replace or to reinforce what seems to be a retreat of global powers, particularly in the West, from the enforcement of enhancing the cost associated with atrocity, the cost associated with violations. And this film, the suggestions that have been made, is one step in trying to build that. But there's so much more that we're going to need to do. just to end, is one of the great disappointments, anger, is that the global health community has been largely absent from this conversation. That the major donors, the major funders, the major academic programs in global health avoid areas of conflict because of the risk, not only to personnel, but risk to the success of projects. And in my view, Michelle organizing this panel, showing this movie, is atypical for global health programs, which tend to focus on areas of the world in need of improved global health, but tend to be relatively stable and view conflict areas as somehow peripheral to the global health imperative.
Thank you, Paul, because I really think the academy and universities need to step up to the plate and discuss this and put this forward. But I it's such a special event that we also have Justin here. I think storytelling like this is so important. And I was looking at where you've been in all these conflict zones. Can you just share a little bit about how important storytelling can be and why all these conflict zones for you?
Okay, well, I've got to just say that when I was at the NewsHour, I was a very good desk jockey, but I was a desk jockey. I was working with some very talented and commissioned and some very talented and passionate folks who had a desire to go, and I worked closely with them, and I made sure that we got the buy-in to go to those places and to show, to give face and to give voice in that. So I personally just think it's a very simple fact that if you can relate to somebody, then you're going to care. And I don't think you can really have that in a 2-minute news package or just hearing, you know, something, you know, on the radio. At the NewsHour, we were blessed that we had 6 to 8 minutes to tell a story and to develop characters. And I just think that that was a way that we decided we'd have sort of the intellectual backbone, we'd explain the conflict. We had all of that. The NewsHour always had that. But the ability to go in and to bring, you know, to show this up close and to meet the people, you know, it had a remarkable effect. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of news organizations who are scaling back and are afraid to cover Yemen. They're not touching it. You know, CBS went into Yemen for 60 Minutes, and that they weren't able to go into all the places they had to send some cameras in. That was good, A+. But they also made no mention in a 10-minute package of what the U.S. relationship is with the Saudis, which is horrible. You know, you do need to have the human connection. Yes, absolutely. But you also have to give people context and explain the world. And I felt like that was a huge missed opportunity. But I think that news organizations need to get back into the habit of being on the ground. And that's difficult for a lot of reasons, but I think they need to be more creative about it.
I'd like to open it up to questions from the audience. And while people are thinking of who wants to ask a question, I do want to ask Earthrin and also all the panelists, what do you do about war fatigue? I mean, we've been watching this war go on for the Syrian war, the Yemen. How do you get those? Go for it.
I'm fatigued by war fatigue. I'm so tired of it. Yeah. You know, we have, most of us are so privileged in this world to be alive now and to have the opportunities for us not to care because we're sick of it. Mm-hmm. I think that's inexcusable. I don't accept that. Mm-hmm. So that's just me.
Well, in less than a week, we'll have been in Syria for 9 years. The Syrian conflict will have been going on for 9 years. And if you ask the average person, they just don't know. Even with Eastern Ghouta, it's not getting, the conflict does not receive the level of attention that the scale of the conflict requires. And Yemen receives absolutely no attention at all. And so to suggest that there is war fatigue And it's the same thing that I hear. It's often, we have donor fatigue, and donors are limiting their contributions. In reality, the donors have never contributed as much to humanitarian response as they are contributing today. The challenge is that we have these protracted crises with more people year on year being affected and the need being ever greater for financial assistance from donors and donor and the donor nations. When I respond to how do you address donor fatigue or war fatigue, I said, we have no other options than to continue to care. Fatigue is not an appropriate response when children are continuing to die, when hospitals are continuing to be bombed. While I have the mic, let me just say thank you to Steve and to my friend here, because this is the documenting and telling this story is so important to ensuring that messages get out there that are not being delivered by the national news. And Michelle, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to participate today. Thank you.
Steve, you wanted to say something.
One negative thing and one positive thing. On the negative side, I mean, we are all struggling against the backdrop of Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we are tired. We are, as a society, we're weary of the unresolved nature of both of those wars, the cost that we have paid, and I think it does tempt us to turn off some of these problems. And when we don't see positive progress on things like UN Security Council Resolution 2286 or any other examples, it can feed a certain kind of pessimism. And so we really have to be very protective of that. On the positive side, I continue to see inspiration coming and hope coming from all of those people that are out there struggling on a day-to-day basis. And included in that are the Syrian American Medical Society, based in the United States, which has become a huge voice of determination and commitment, and which is conveying this reality. I continue to be impressed with the leadership of, that we've seen from Erthrin, and from Erthrin's successor, Governor Beasley from South Carolina, who is passionate, committed, very impactful, that we're seeing people at the leadership ranks who are very determined and very committed to this. And the last thing I'd say is, we have a society that has a lot of people in it, including our faith community, who still object to the notion that people suffer innocently and massively, and that has to be, as a matter of principle, opposed, even in the darkest moments. And so I don't think we should walk away from this film with a sense of resignation and pessimism. I mean, I think we need to be realistic and sober in this, but I do think that there are pathways of action. There are folks that are out there doing things that are inspiring. There are leaders that we see in this administration, in the UN agency, a setting at the NGO level that are still very, very impactful and inspiring.
Well, are there questions from the audience? And while we're taking a question, I do want to let people know that there is a refugee action project at Stanford. And if you're interested in getting involved, please look up our website.
My first comments are a combination of amazement and admiration and appreciation. All three A's of the work you're all doing, and thank you very much. And my second observation is not only I'm witnessing, I'm hearing that there is a deliberate military action against hospitals and healthcare workers to attack them as a strategy to put horror in these war zones. But I want to bring to awareness that there are many dictators in the world that are actually adamantly denying, rejecting humanitarian aid. And I think maybe I didn't get it from that wonderful film, but I think that's something that also needs to be brought into the equation. How all these decision makers in these countries and in other countries, in other parts in the world, like in Venezuela, they are actively denying, rejecting humanitarian aid. And that is a horrible, horrible situation as well. So,
thank you. I think you're right. And I think maybe we have another film. You know, I think there's only so much you can put in a film, but I do think that's worth exploring. I think that's a good idea. Because you're absolutely right, that is going on and it's not being covered adequately.
Yeah, Venezuela wouldn't even allow the humanitarian community in to assess the level of need. But I also think we need to be honest about our own country, the United States. We rejected international assistance for Puerto Rico, just as we did for Katrina. So this is not, you know, we don't, there is, yes, we have a challenge with the rejection of humanitarian assistance. But I think that we also need to realize that even we have places where we have weak governance or lack of governance, and you have the leaderships that take no responsibility for humanitarian response, and they entirely rely upon the international community to provide the assistance that is required for their population. And South Sudan is a great example of that situation.
Thank you for each of you for your wonderful contribution. The question I had is, you mentioned that perhaps now is not necessarily the time for an international policy solution, but you really urge country-specific policy changes, especially those with large military presence. Could you just add detail and specificity for what you would like to see for country-specific proposals?
One on legal reform by the United States. To build on Erthrin's comment, there are specific provisions within the law of the manual of war right now that need revision, need clarification in order to protect medical operations in conflict, and they do operate in tension with counterterrorism law. And in order to change those requires, as Erthrin was arguing, a coalition that's willing to really push on that and build bipartisan support for that. And that is going to take some time. We're involved in starting an effort in that area. And there are a number of experts who have been examining this problem very carefully. The point here, I think, is to reach out to those who have been general counsels at DOD, at the White House, at the CIA, at the State Department, who have been vested with the power to make these wartime decisions about the translation of what can be done and what cannot be done, and get them to stand behind a reform agenda, and then get bipartisan support, particularly within the U.S. Senate, around that. And I think that is possible in a 2 or 3 year time frame. I don't think it's, Erthrin, you may disagree with me, maybe it's a 10-year time frame. But I think that is one thing that is very concrete and very specific. I also think that right now within the U.N. Security Council, you have Sweden and the Netherlands are on the Security Council. You have a total of 5 European powers, all of which are deeply committed to the notion of putting more teeth into these resolutions and attempting to hold to account those that are egregious violators and are willing to push. And so we have an opportunity diplomatically right now to cooperate with them around what might that mean. And I don't suggest that there's any easy solution, but I think we've reached a clear point where a different set of actions vis-a-vis Russia and Iran and Assad are required if you're talking about Syria, and that we need to continue to push hard on the U.S. security relationship with the Saudis in Yemen, just to cite 2 of the critical challenges that require much more aggressive action and holding to account. And the last thing I'd say is that data has been problematic in this area. High-level political will is tied to convincing and standardized and credible data. Data is improving now, but we're still a distance off. We're still off by a distance at getting the kind of powerful data that we need, and we should be pushing as hard as possible and investing as much as we can in the efforts that WHO, International Committee of the Red Cross, MSF, Safeguarding Coalition are doing. All four of those are actively pushing hard. We should be putting as much resources as we can into those efforts.
Paul, did you want to add to that?
Amen. But also, there is interest among all the different NGOs and UN agencies to take a step back and try to build a stronger consensus on what the highest priority steps should be in this arena. There is considerable heterogeneity among the different groups, even within these groups, about risk, about ways to better protect the humanitarian enterprise, and to address contradictions within the humanitarian approach that are increasingly destructive given the changing nature of the warfare. For example, neutrality is based on making no distinction between victim and perpetrator in the humanitarian space. But that is unacceptable for many in these arenas, and therefore are confronting new interpretations or new strategies to provide essential humanitarian services in areas plagued by profound, protracted, violent conflict. And it may be that there needs to be a reassessment, or at least a reaffirmation, of the essential components of the international humanitarian law related to service provision and the protection of humanitarian and health workers in these environments.
May I just very quickly just say I appreciate the comments of both of you, and I personally agree with both of you. But I am, part of my success to date has been I am a pragmatist about many issues, particularly in this situation where anti-terrorism laws in the United States today are in direct opposition to international humanitarian law. The reality is that the war on terror, particularly related to Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-related entities, has a significant amount of U.S.-American support. And the challenge is where we've even had cases where doctors who have supported Al-Qaeda have been prosecuted in the United States. And the international humanitarian law clearly states that combatants who are injured must have access to medical care. But we make a distinction in the United States with Al-Qaeda as a combatant. Building a bipartisan coalition in this country to overcome that
bias,
thank you, is, I would say, going to take us a little more than 3 years. But I think that it is well worth pursuing, because it is a slippery slope. When I attended the funeral of Nelson Mandela, and the former president of Tanzania at the funeral spoke, and he said, what the world does not want to state today as we celebrate the life of Nelson Mandela was that for most of his adult life, Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist. And so, as he said, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And I am not in any way suggesting that we should comport Nelson Mandela with Al-Qaeda. But the reality is, when we make exceptions for Al-Qaeda, it is pulling a string that could potentially impact how we respond in other settings as well, for who we serve and who we do not serve. And this is a conversation that I believe that academics and policy leaders and those who care about these issues must begin to encourage across this entire nation. Because we have not had a conversation about international humanitarian law and anti-terrorism and the effect that it has on our abilities to address a challenge that I believe that most Americans would agree to, and that is human suffering. No, Americans do not support human suffering. And we see that time and again when there, whether it is a quick onset emergencies or seeing babies dying of cholera or severe malnutrition in a place like Yemen, when they expect humanitarians to act, and that is why Congress continues to provide the financial support that is necessary for humanitarians to act, because there is a belief that we should respond to human suffering. But when we must address, or we will continue to see pictures like these, the challenges between anti-terror and anti-terrorism campaigns and international humanitarian law.
First of all, Paul, thank you for bringing up the tension between, you know, the necessity to maintain integrity, legal integrity of, you know, the legal integrity of, you know, absolute neutral stance, and, you know, the practical need to actually deliver the aid. That's very fascinating, that tension. And also Earth and Night, you know, the logistic tragicomedy situation you brought up with, you know, need paying people to, you know, deliver aid, but, you know, actually not paying them a lot of money, but actually not getting it through. That was also very education illuminating. Thank you for sharing. And Steve, you mentioned, when you mentioned the world is becoming a more fractured place, you know, in terms of enforcing the Geneva Convention, that reminds me of that scene from, you know, Bridge Over the River Kwai, in which, you know, Colonel Nicholson told Colonel Saito, you know, about the Geneva Convention, or Colonel Saito said, you know, like, you speak of code, what code? You know, the coward's code. So I guess the question is, you know, because in the documentary, and you all mentioned that there's a deliberate move towards attacking humanitarian aids, and I can see that working in a place like Syria, where, you know, there was, you know, more or less, relatively speaking, more development. And, you know, when you take away that, you know, medical infrastructure, it impacts people very greatly. But in a place, I also see that Bangui was featured in the documentary, you know, in a place like that, where medical coverage was spotty at best, even in the best of times. So in this situation, you know, it seems like the strategy of attacking humanitarian aid is applied in both situations, but the losses, you know, are quite different. So, you know, what is the reason? Is this a strategy that people are just blindly following? What do they get out of it? And, you know, how can we help by, you know, taking the incentive away from using such a strategy? Is this more aimed towards the population within the conflict zone, or is this more aimed as propaganda to the people outside? You know, as a sort of a world, you know, geopolitical stance, saying, you know, I don't care about your values, and I'm doing this. You know, that to me, that seems more irrational. If you're trying to actually win in a conflict, then, you know, it seems to make more sense to attack your population, which is misguided. But I, you know, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this. Thank you.
We need to be better positioned to, with specific facts, hold both state and non-state violators to account. Right now, there's not an annualized record-keeping of performance on these issues. There is on children in war, as mandated through a UN Security Council action. And that has resulted in states changing their behavior because they don't want to be on that list, where they're seen as perennially negligent and violent towards children in their sovereign space. We don't do that today on the topic that's in this documentary. It would be hard to imagine Russia voting for such a thing in the Security Council, but there's got to be other ways to skin the cat here. And that got back, that gets me back to the point about data and reliable and coherent and credible standardized data. If we begin to get that from multiple sources and it's quality, it has demonstrated quality, it can be then thrown back at these states and non-states with a consistent, in a consistent way, that may or may not work. I think there's other things, that measures that have been that have not been taken specifically with respect to the Russians in terms of sanctions and directly targeting individuals. Those actions have not been taken to the degree that they could. And yet we've now reached a point, if you're reading the papers and the social media debates over Eastern Ghouta, we've now entered a debate in the last week in which people are saying that we should simply abandon the humanitarian enterprise because it's just a hollow shell that is achieving nothing. I mean, we've reached the point of desperation in which those arguments are coming forward because it's seen as a charade that that simply goes on while this murderous behavior carries forward with absolutely no penalties. Well, that to me, that suggests that we're missing some options. And I'm not suggesting that the current incumbents in the White House are prepared to do any of that, but it's something that should be tabled around direct action against Russia in ways that have not been taken up to now.
I'd like to thank you all so much for your work on this issue in various ways. And then my question is, I guess this topic was brought up a little bit in the film, but could you expand a little bit more on why each of you think the reaction in the US media has been so different with regards to Syria compared to, say, Yemen, the violence in South Sudan, other conflicts where similar atrocities are happening? Seems like only Syria has really captured the media attention, including social media. So just interested to know why that is.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Syria is undercovered, but you're absolutely right. You've got Yemen, South Sudan, CAR, there's a bunch of other conflicts. And the unfortunate reality is there's just not that much of an appetite for it. And I think that we need to, I think it's incumbent on journalists to kind of speak up, to go to these places and to cover it. And sometimes that, and I just know this from my own experiences, you actually have to lobby to do this. Like, you actually have to really get in people's face and just say, hey, this is important and this is why. You got to make them care. You got to go to your managing editor, you go to your executive producer, and you got to say, here is why this matters. And I think we need to see more of that, because we haven't. And you're absolutely right. A lot of these other places are completely undercovered, and they're not getting the attention that they deserve. But unfortunately, with what's happened in Eastern Ghouta, this will be around. This will spark, and it has sparked, a pretty intense social media debate. But it's still very much I kind of look at it as sort of a closed echo chamber. They're different in size, but it's not really, I don't think it's having a widespread penetration. And I do think that this is a problem, that we're just not paying enough attention to this right now.
You know, when I said my friend here, that was for a reason. Thank God for PBS NewsHour and NPR, because those were the only places that would allow me to come and tell the story of Somalia and in Syria and even of Yemen. And the challenges that we, again, where is, we need to build that coalition of support and demands from the American public for more information regarding these events around the world. But I'm not naive enough to believe that is going to happen unless there is some catalyst that drives interest in the general public. And without that, the news media is not going to cover it.
I have to share a conversation I had this morning with Ted Koppel. So I went to talk to Ted Koppel about some of these issues, and he basically said to me that unless I can bring it, that I'm going to be knocking my head against the wall, that unless I can bring the issues that I want to raise into the U.S. living room, where it affects the U.S. person, I am absolutely going to get nowhere. He said, no news coverage is going to happen for you. And he said, I wouldn't put this on any show. So that is the main U.S., and that's not PBS, and that's not NPR, but that's kind of an answer to some of the questions. Rachel, you were there for that conversation today. It was quite striking.
I would just argue, I think that shows an extreme lack of creativity, but also just laziness to the facts. We are supporting Saudi Arabia. We are giving them weapons. We're giving them targeted information. We're doing that. This is our tax dollars at work. And you can be on whatever side you want to be of that, whether you think we should be doing it or not doing it. But as journalists, it is our obligation to show that.
I would say, as our government, we should have more transparency, because that is not right now being very transparent. Yes.
Again, thank you all for coming. I guess this is more of an existential question about the fate of humanitarianism and the international community. The documentary mentioned that the term international community carries relatively little weight, and also mentioned that now is not the time, again, to take another look at the Geneva Convention. If the nature of war is changing, as is mentioned in the film, and if the international community is losing its significance, is there ever going to be a time at which we have the sort of resolve to create something like the Geneva Convention again, or is it just now time that humanitarianism is permanently relegated to national legislation?
I don't think we were... Richard Haass's comment in the film about what does it mean when we throw the term international community around, I think he was delivering fair warning that we have to be very careful in implying that there's a powerful coalition of the major interests allied around any particular issue. That it's a term that oftentimes gets used in a fairly loose and somewhat lazy fashion. But I don't think that that forecloses the idea that you could build a nucleus of serious powers around an agenda, and a humanitarian agenda. So I hope you don't go home with the conclusion that there is no international community in the sense there's never going to be a kind of empowered nucleus coalition that can drive things forward, because there's plenty of examples we can point to. It just takes a very determined effort to create that in this very fractured situation that we're in right now. And I do think that that's possible. And I don't think that humanitarianism as a doctrine and a set of values is dead by any means.
I just want to support that last statement that Steve made, and because I think it's important that you leave here with some sense of encouragement about the state of humanitarianism. Last year, in 2017, there were four countries on the verge of famine. But because of humanitarian response, because access was given where access was required to ensure support for affected populations, millions of lives were saved. And we avoided famine in all but one county in one state in South Sudan. And so humanitarianism and the humanitarian response and humanitarian action continues to save millions of lives on a daily basis. But the reality of it is, it's never been easy, and it's getting more difficult. And I think that is what the film illustrates in no uncertain terms. I would also say, I agree that the international community does exist, but an international community without U.S. leadership is not going to get the job done. And I am just not, I am pessimistic about the U.S. leading an international coalition that would call out Russia today. And so I am concerned about what that means for the Security Council when Russia has a veto, and also concerned about what that means for collective action around any particular response to activities that or bad behavior that may occur and affect humanitarian response.
The humanitarian world has always had to adapt. It was born out of the ruins of World War II, had to adapt to the Cold War, and there were complex challenges associated with functioning in that environment. And now we're faced with new types of challenges, and adaptation is required. And this film and this conversation is part of this effort to adapt to the new reality. Also, the humanitarian world has changed. It is far larger, far more bureaucratized in many ways, and some of the challenges that are being voiced among the NGOs in this world, in this set of activities, is a reflection of how they have changed as well. But the requirement to adapt and respond has always been there, and I'm personally confident, and particularly with a group like this on the stage with me, confident that that adaptation, that conversation, that needed dialogue is underway, and that we will continue to adapt in ways that ultimately will be far more effective and ultimately rewarding.
So maybe to the nature of that, those adaptations, the Geneva Conventions have come up a lot tonight, the idea of revitalizing international humanitarian law, but this really doesn't get at the issue of the shift towards more irregular forms of warfare. And even if you could achieve consensus on some of those issues, those frameworks don't hold legitimacy for a lot of the parties to conflict, a lot of the groups that are perpetrating acts against aid workers. So can we be a little more concrete about some of the policy and or logistical options that might exist to address that?
The current four Geneva Conventions and the two additional protocols of 1977, they don't really adequately cover the irregular forces, non-state actors, and they don't cover instances like we've seen with ISIL or Al-Qaeda of powerful non-state actors who stake out a position of complete hostility and antipathy towards this. And as we heard from Paul about the complexities of operating in the siege of Mosul, so the debate that it would that exists right now is how do you characterize these? How do you categorize them? How do you communicate with them? By what terms? And how do you put that into doctrine? How do you put that into active military protocols for the way in which we operate in the field? And if you're not going to reopen the Geneva Conventions, then you need more thinking at a national level about our rules of engagement and our protocols for military action in a warfare setting with these actors as prevalent players in the field. And that is the focus right now of a lot of the debate of what needs to happen. And there's no ready-made easy answer. I mean, particularly when you're dealing with an ISIL or Al-Qaeda case study, and it's led to, I mean, MSF attempted to deal with them. They had 10 people kidnapped for 6 months. They made an internal determination that this was not going to be a possibility henceforth. We're still struggling with this. Mm-hmm. Paul?
Well, Hannah and I have spoken about this quite a bit. She knows I have no easy answers. But I do think how the United States and coalition partners address the challenge in the field has been critically misplayed in many ways that have undermined not only the success of these military operations, but have also undermined the legitimacy of the humanitarian actors in the same space. And I think this is changing somewhat, but the tactics and the strategies that have been implemented in these areas have undergone considerable change. And we saw Boko Haram attacked in Rwanda, northeast Nigeria, just this week, and in many respects was a reflection of the tactics being used by the Nigerian military in ways that were intensely counterproductive. And so I do think we need greater diplomatic approaches, but also a better understanding of in bello conduct that would reduce the ability of these non-state combatant forces to wreak havoc and to undermine the humanitarian capability in these areas.
Thanks.
Unfortunately, sometimes that militarizes. I mean, what Pakistan has done with the vaccinators, the polio vaccinators, has basically militarized the vaccinators with, I mean, there are pragmatic ways to approach it. It's just not so palatable.
This is a kind of a controversial question because it, on some ends, goes against the humanitarian ideal. But we're in a world where, you know, at least the American government has determined that force is necessary to stop countries from breaking certain international laws, like the use of chemical weapons, the attack in Syria. Do you think there's going to be a case where the government decides to step in to prevent an attack on American doctors or something like that? If that hypothetically happened, what would you think of that strategy?
Can you clarify that? I'm sorry. There's definitely been chemical war used in Syria. What was the question? Well,
I mean, the American government has decided that we're willing to use force to retaliate against Syria.
Okay,
for that.
The red line that Obama put in the sand. Irfan, you were talking about.
Trump did cross it.
You were talking about that last night, the red line where Obama said, "This is my line. If you're going to use chemical weapons, we're going to retaliate."
Right, and then he, rather than making an executive decision, turned to Congress, and there was no appetite in Congress for military action in Syria, and so nothing occurred. The reality of it is where the Pew Research has shown that the U.S. public does not support military action in response to the humanitarian activities, violations of international humanitarian law. The where they do not see a clear U.S. interest, and but they do support and this is reflected in how we have responded, air attacks and some special forces to address challenges, but putting large numbers of U.S. soldiers on the ground in response to violations of international humanitarian law, I do not believe that there is a bipartisan coalition in Congress that would support such action, nor do I believe that this administration would support such action today. And so we are limited to the tools of what we have seen used in response, and that is the airstrikes and special forces. And special forces are now, as you know, on the ground in Syria, on the ground in Somalia, as well as in Iraq. And so I think that and they're on the ground in Nigeria and Niger. And we saw that the response to that from the American people when we lost soldiers. As soon as we lose troops in response to who are responding to these activities, it becomes a very unpopular action here in the United States.
Well, I think we should probably end now because we've got a little. No. I'm gonna be more positive about this. I wanna actually thank Steve and Justin incredibly for bringing these stories to Stanford. And I sort of wanted to end with, you talked about data and intelligence and what we can do. Can you share, there are students in the audience, there are faculty, researchers, what can the academy bring to the plate to make a difference?
Well, there's not an immediately available campaign to plug into in this particular issue set. Most of the groups that have been organizing, like Susanna Sirkin and Physicians for Human Rights, they are very oriented around the conflicts, harvesting data, processing it, and then bringing it to the tables of the Security Council members. It's not an outward-looking campaign. There could be a campaign, potentially. Here on campus, and we're going to be at Berkeley on Wednesday, there's the lab that does the research. Here you have a refugee project and program. You have these very important initiatives that allow students to plug in and contribute and be directly engaged in something that's relevant to this, in building both political will within this university to lead on these issues, but also to creating concrete, pragmatic results that bring benefits to those who are in harm's way or suffering. So there are these concrete initiatives. There's not a broad national campaign at this point. I would also say it's very important to vote. And we are in
midterm
a year
elections
in which
really
the vote, if I were to advise a student to do one thing, or a faculty member, is to get out, get registered, and vote this fall, which may be the most impactful vote of your lifetime.
Well, I'm going to end here, and thank you very much for the gift of bringing this story to Stanford.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you liked this episode, even if it made you want to build your own bomb shelter, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And you can subscribe to stay up to date with what's going on in the world and why.